Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, Simon shares his wisdom on how to have a richer life. Lee lays into the big banks paying offensive interest on our savings. We explore what will happen to house prices, offer some reassuring words for first-time buyers, and arm you with the tools to make sure you get every penny you're owed from all this travel disruption. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, if there are rules to follow for a richer life, what are they? Over his many years as editor of This Is Money, you'd expect Simon to have picked up a thing or two. So he's decided to distill all of that knowledge, or some of it, into his 10 money rules. Simon, before we get to the rules, why have you been pondering this? You know, seems a strange thing to think about in a cost of living crisis as to how to, let's not be rich, but to live a richer life. Why have you been pondering this?
What a question. Well, because I think that it's good to think about these things sometimes. And often we focus on the big in-depth guides and go deep, deep into the detail of how you can do things, should do things, what you should be thinking about. Sometimes some stuff that's just a little bit briefer to the point, some just general things to think about is a good thing to do. And then you can expand on them as you choose to. And you've got to remember that the best way for you to live a richer life is to know about your finances. You don't need to be a financial expert, but knowing the basics of saving, borrowing, investing, managing your money, it will pay off. And as I said in my column I wrote this week, you've got to consider what you're up against. There are lots of clever people out there wanting to take your money off you. Not fraudsters. There are some fraudsters, obviously, but you know, legit businesses. Prime Day, for example, or that 3 for 2 or bog off offer. Now, I mean, they would like you to think that that offer is in place because they are altruistic and they want to help you. The supermarkets definitely want people to think that now. That's not true. They've created that offer to advance their interests, not yours. It's to sell you more stuff. It's to make you buy stuff that you weren't going to buy. The alternative would be to just make stuff a bit cheaper if you only want one of them. And this is actually something that cropped up in the food government's food review thing. The thing they got Henry Dimbleby involved in, didn't it? And this suggestion of they wanted to ban offers on junk food, I think it was. And it was suggested that this was the wrong time to do that, or processed, heavily processed foods, because we were in a cost of living crisis, and that you shouldn't be putting the price of stuff up, costing people more, taking more money out of families' pockets, which is just complete nonsense, because those deals on the processed food are not done for the benefit of families suffering from the cost of living crisis. But yeah, so everyone's after your money. Banks, credit card companies, investment managers, supermarkets, estate agents, online retail giants, even the corner shops at it. Mm-hmm. They want your money too. So your job is to keep your wits about you, get an understanding of your finances.
So it's not my fault, Simon, is what you're saying. It's not my fault. Everybody wants my money and I am blithely walking around handing out my credit card and debit cards and spending, and it's not.
It is. Of course, it's your responsibility. So that's the thing. You've got to take responsibility for this stuff yourself.
Rule number one: take responsibility. I don't think that was your rule number one.
It wasn't rule number one. Okay. I only had 10. There could have been many more. Also, I deliberately left out some things. So, for example, I didn't put in there buy a property if it suits you and you can afford it, because house prices are at a record high compared to wages. Interest rates are going up. And there's lots of people out there who would like to buy a property, but for whom it is an impossibility. So it doesn't help if they read some money rules for life. And one of them is buy a house. And it's like, oh, thanks, sunshine, from your nice lofty home owning position for giving me that piece of advice. I haven't got a hope in hell of ever managing to do that. So I didn't include that. Then also, the other thing just to say on the cost of living crisis stuff is there is a cost of living crisis for some people at the moment. There are people out there who cannot make ends meet. There are people on low incomes or who have low amounts of wealth. And there are people for whom there is the choice between heating and eating, or there will be. They're definitely not making the choice between heating and eating at the moment. Nobody's got the heating on right now. There are people who are having to rely on food banks. There are elderly people who are finding that their income doesn't go far enough and they're having to run down their savings with no way of replenishing it because they're retired and they can't work anymore. And there's younger people as well. I think they often get forgotten about, the people in their 20s who are working, but they haven't had a lifetime or part of a lifetime to make much in the way of savings yet. And they struggle to not end up below zero at the end of every month. They're paying expensive rents. They've still got the same, you know, energy bills and everything else as the rest of us. And they don't have the savings to rely on because they haven't had a chance to build it up yet. So for those people, I think there is a cost of living crisis. I also think that for an awful lot of people in this country, there isn't a cost of living crisis. There's some very painful inflation. I am not happy about the fact that my energy bills have doubled, but it will pass. We take the hit on the chin. And yeah, it does mean that we're going to have to maybe dip into our savings, or we're going to have to cut back on some of the discretionary spending that we do. We're going to have to cut back on some of the stuff we enjoy on because the essentials are costing us more. But I don't think it's accurate to say that there is a cost of living crisis for everybody in this country at the moment.
No, I agree. And let's hope this is something of a blip, obviously a terrible blip for some people, but in terms of it, hopefully it's not going to last forever. And your rules, to get back to the rules, are hopefully things that you can bring in permanently.
Yeah, these are like such general, like, you know, whole of life stuff. This is just the things that I think are important.
Yeah. So what are they?
Okay. Number one,
run it down.
Learn to budget and save a rainy day fund. Budgeting, quite important. The old spend less than you've got coming in thing. I did say that the right way around, didn't I? Yeah, and then save yourself that rainy day fund, that pot of money that you can rely on if something goes wrong. You need that. That's essential. Learn to love compound interest and returns. Start small, save early, and save regularly. Now, obviously, compound interest isn't what it used to be when interest rates were much higher, but it still works. You still get a little bit more gains on gains and everything. And it definitely works for investing. So number three is invest over the long term and learn to love compounding even more. This is where something like dividend payments come in. You get those dividend payments coming in, reinvested every year, then that's a really powerful driver of long-term returns. Number four, buy things that last and are worth the price. We spend a lot of money on a lot of stuff. And the best stuff is always the stuff that some might have had to pay for quality, but the stuff that lasts. We can all think of some of those items that we've got, and we can all think of absolute junk that we've wasted money on. Number five, before you buy or invest, ask, why is this person trying to sell this to me? That moment where you pause and go, this hot tub on Amazon Prime Day that says it's 50% off. Lee Boyce will recognize this because he was sat opposite me in the office the other day when I was mulling over buying a hot tub. I was like, I don't even want a hot tub. Number six, save and invest, but enjoy the money that you can afford to spare. We've talked about this before. It's not just about the money in itself. It's about what you can do with it and enjoying it. You've got to allow yourself that. And some of the rule of thumb budgeting stuff that you get has that, what was it, 50% for your essentials, 30% for enjoying life, 20% for saving. That's one of the kind of rule of thumbs thing. Number seven, borrow carefully and wisely and pay it off. Last bit is quite important. Don't just have it sitting there paying interest to other people. When you're borrowing, you're effectively borrowing from your future. So don't borrow too much from your future. Number eight, be generous when you can afford it. I think that's a very good principle in life. Number nine, your power to earn is the thing most likely to make you richer. And number 10, don't be afraid to take some risks, but do be prepared for things not going to plan. I.e., it's okay if you want to put a little bit of money into something quite risky, but don't put all your money in there because it might go wrong. And that's the 10. That's my list. What do you
like think? That. Lee, come in. What would you add to that list?
Hi, Georgie. Well, in that list, I think I would definitely put in something about not trying to keep up with the Joneses or whatever the newer version of that is. You know, there's a lot of my friends that are seemingly just buying bigger homes, silly new cars on ridiculous finance deals. I mean, personally speaking, I think buy a nearly used car, do it on the cheapest finance possible, own the actual car, not just keep going around in loops, you know, with sort of PCB deals and stuff like that. And, you know, you buy a home, and I'd like to think you would want to stay in that home for maybe 5, maybe 10 years. I know that's not always, there's no one size fits all, but there's a lot of people, I think, that overstretch themselves. So maybe that's the key, don't overstretch yourself. As Simon said, I mean, I'm a big fan of spending my spare time looking at compounding calculators. Also, I think I'd add to that is tax can be taxing, right? So you need to get on top of learning about pension tax relief. You need to know how you can open tax-free savings accounts, all of that kind of thing, because the tax man's always after a grab of what you've got. And also on that same sort of vein, I would say that fixing could be pretty fantastic. So what I mean by that is, you know, last year when mortgage rates were so low, I thought that's ridiculous. You know, never going to be that low again. 5-year fix straight in. And my energy deal had to fix last year. It was such a ridiculously low price. I took the longest fix possible. Bit of hindsight. But sometimes when you see those really like low rates, I think you just got to grab it and go for it. This similar vein, Simon, I think we do buy too much stuff. You do get what you pay for in terms of quality. And if you are going to buy stuff, clothes, whatever, sell other stuff as you go along to try and boost your coffers and reduce the cost and the outlay of what it is that you're buying. I think a really important one, if you have children, saving for your children, to be able to give them a leg up. And I'm not talking about serious, massive, life-changing amounts of money. I'm talking about tucking away a little bit of cash every month. And you think over the 18 years, you know, that could grow into something pretty sizable that will help them when they reach adulthood. And you can explain to them how you built that pot up, how compounding works, all of that kind of stuff. And it could help for driving lessons, university, potentially getting them on the housing ladder. And I think that can only be a good thing. And lastly, George, I would say you have got to live in the moment. Yeah, live for the moment, you know, because life is short. You don't know what's around the corner. And I don't think you want to constantly deprive yourself of life experiences, things that you can share with friends, family, and if possible, save up for those big ticket items. So if you know this time next year, you want a holiday, say once in a lifetime, but a really good holiday, and you know roughly how much that's going to cost, you know, start saving for it now, if you can, if you have savings. It makes such a difference when you come around to paying it off next year and, you know, saving up for holiday money and that kind of thing. You know, and even things like concert tickets and gig tickets and sporting events and all of that kind of stuff. I like to have a little pot of cash that I've got on the side that I use to dip into buy those kind of like, I'm not going to say they're extravagant, but they're kind of like life experiences for me, my daughter, my wife, friends. And as I say, but you've got to have a balance of it all. And that's what I would add.
Marvellous. I'll be honest with you, I wasn't that prepared. I've just jotted a few notes down while you were speaking, so I haven't thought too much about this. But, you know, apart from the things you've already said, I would add, know thyself. That is, to me, so important. Know why you spend, how it makes you feel, you know what, how your parents did, how your attitude towards money is. Great advice from my dad once: go with what you know and the money will follow. There's a few times in my career I've thought, oh, I don't know, I just do something completely different. I never did, and I stuck at it. And here I am, absolutely loaded. What can I say? Life hack. Look, if you know that you can't be bothered, either get someone else to do it, or there's loads of apps out there. Find it out. Again, I suppose that goes down to know yourself. Hang around with supportive people. And I get this is like keeping up with the Joneses sort of thing. No point in hanging around with friends that are pushing you to spend loads of money that, you know, sounds a bit ruthless, but nah, get rid of it. Just get started. Anything you want to do in life sounds obvious, but just get started. Don't be afraid to ask. Most people don't know what they're talking about, so it's okay that you don't either. Take a little breather. If you're at a shop, thinking about buying something, walk away. If you can still remember it, this is the great thing about having a terrible memory, great, buy it. Most times you won't. And then the final one is, do not go for the free football at Freshers' Fair in return for a credit card. The credit card will last about 15 years longer than the football, which I think lasted for about 48 hours.
I think that's a lovely list there, Georgie. Yeah. I'm just going to add one thing to that about you mentioned your dad there. I think that's actually one life lesson that we could probably add in there is learn from your parents. We're going to learn from my parents' mistakes. My dad isn't great with money. He, you know, he's made some pretty bad decisions over the years. And actually a lot of what I do in my own financial life is the opposite of what he done. So, you know, no offense, Dad, if you're listening, but, you know, I do kind of live my life sort of in a different kind of way, seeing how actually money problems and issues in my younger life affected my parents because of some bad decisions that were made. That has heavily influenced what I do now. So I think you can always sort of learn and glean stuff from your parents and your wider family.
Important. Yeah, really important.
I think that is really important. And I just before I say this, I think actually it's not called keeping up with the Joneses nowadays. It's called keeping up with the Sunaks. So it's all about wanting those flip-flops that cost all that money and the really expensive water bottle and the mug that makes your coffee for you and everything like that. And then you forget, obviously, that it's handy if your wife's a near billionaire.
I thought the Joneses were just like your next door neighbours that have got a nice new car, not people that are worth billions of pounds, Simon. I mean, who can keep up with that? Anyway.
The other thing I was going to say on a more pertinent note is your know thyself one. That's quite important because everybody has a different relationship with money. They interact with their finances differently. For some people, it's something that is always a big concern and they're always very worried about, even if they've got plenty of it. For other people, it's something that they find very difficult to get their head around, very confusing, and they really struggle with the financial stuff. For other people, they find it relatively easy. And look, some people's relationship with money is they see it as an enabler. It's I'll get money and it enables me to do things. That's the point of the money for me. Other people see money as something that they have to just accumulate and accumulate and accumulate because they've got to get that money there and that buffer. Others find it to be, you know, a real problem and it goes through their hands like water. And they find themselves, you know, potentially racking up big debts and things like that. And it's not even about that kind of debt, wealth kind of thing there. It's the higher level above that. Like, what is your relationship with it? And how do you interact with it? And even if you just sit for 15 minutes and think about this, you will come out of that a little bit wiser on why you do some of the things you do and then how you can try to help yourself. So for example, if you are that person who finds it really awkward and confusing and you really struggle with it, you just go, okay, well, look, this is not my fault. I'm not particularly comfortable with this. What can I do about this? Well, I shouldn't stress myself out about it. I shouldn't put so much pressure on myself. It is a difficult thing to understand. I can go and I can try and learn more about this. Maybe I can dedicate a little bit of time every week to learning a bit more. Maybe I need to go out and buy a really good personal finance book explainer or something like that. Or maybe I need to find my friend or my relative who's one of those people who gets it and understands it and get them to help me a bit. Likewise, if you're one of those people for whom it goes through your hands like water, you can go, right, okay, actually my relationship with money is not great. I have a real problem with like spending too much of it. What can I do to try and stop myself from doing it? And I promise you, this is definitely one of those things where if you just go sit somewhere quietly with no distractions, you know, ideally somewhere outside and nice, don't take your phone, right? That's just like number one. Don't take your phone. Because you're not going to go spend 15 minutes doing some quiet panic scrolling. You go spend 15 minutes sitting there and just thinking about it. Then that's the first step to helping yourself along the way. Yeah. And maybe also the other thing is automate everything you possibly can in terms of like getting money out of your account every month to save and things like that. But maybe just diarize a time. I mean, I can't believe I just said that. I hate that. That is so
get
not
out
me.
Your spreadsheets.
But if my wife listens to this and hears me say the words diarize a time, she will fall over laughing. I'm incredibly badly organized. But set a time each month where you sit down and maybe you just spend half an hour just doing all of that kind of financial stuff. Because I must admit, I am much worse at it now than I used to be. I used to be much better at it when I wasn't as busy as I am, and I didn't have children. And now I'm flat out busy all the time at work. There's never enough minutes in the day. And I've got two kids and I never have time to do all of this stuff. So I'm nowhere near as on top of it as I used to be.
You need to send yourself a Google invite, Simon, and just schedule that time in.
Just so to be clear,
it's a work meeting.
If I send myself a Google invite, I will ignore the Google invite.
Okay.
This is why my wife would be falling around laughing at me saying diarize some time.
Right. And this goes to the heart of the fact that there are rules to a richer life, but some are just oh so difficult to follow. But one rule that you should not ignore is never let the banks take the sip with our savings, because we're doing it. Britain's biggest high street banks are still keeping rates at rock bottom levels. Worst offender, Step Up Barclays, pays its loyal customers just 0.01% on an easy access account, which, by the way, is the same pitiful rate it offered when the base rate was 0.1%. 6 months and I believe five rises ago. Yet, surprise, surprise, Barclays is merrily raising its borrowing costs. So from the 1st of August, its default rate will rise to 5.74%, one of the highest around. Lee, let's not only pick on Barclays here, as there are, of course, other offenders, but it seems a good place to start. So Barclays.
Yeah, I think we've got to start with Barclays, Georgie. And actually, this is what's influenced a little bit of this story, as in we have our savings Best Buy tables littered on This Is Money, which are vastly popular. People come and look for the best rates. I've got fed up, decided to do Worst Buy tables. You know, let's highlight the banks that are offering the worst easy access and the worst fixed rates in a time which we're seeing challengers clamber over each other once again to start offering much better rates, right? So some of the banks have been slowly nudging up rates very, very, very gently. But Barclays is the one that stubbornly kept its easy access rate at 0.01%, aka you'll earn 10p on every £10,000 saved if you have that account, which is absolutely ridiculous. And there will be people that will have money parked in an account like that. At the same time, as you rightly point out, the mortgage SVR is going to 5.74% from the 1st of August. The gap between that and the easy access rate is just, you know, pure profit. And it's absolutely crazy how wide that gap has got. But you're right, it's not just Barclays. And to be frank, other banks are typically offering no more really than 0.2, 0.25% on easy access. And there's billions of pounds that are parked in these accounts, Georgie. Lots of people have a current account and might have just shunted a bit of cash in there just to keep it all under one roof. And it all adds up, and it means the banks are essentially getting away with it. Just to add to this, though, there's a couple of banks and building societies that are making some improvements to their accounts. So, for example, now with Nationwide, you can get 1.3% on its triple access. Now, it's not a pure easy access. You can access the money three times a year without penalty, which would suit a fair amount of people, I would suggest. However, if you're a customer of Nationwide, you will need to move your cash to get that, because it's just regular easy access is as low as 0.16. So you have to move your cash to take advantage of that. Santander boosted its rates to 0.75% for easy access. Now, that doesn't sound great, but it's still better than most of the other high street banks. Again, you've got to move your cash over to it, George, if you've got another easy access with it, because you could be earning as low as 0.01% still, or that's just, sorry, 0.1%. So you have to open these new issues to take advantage of any kind of rate rises. Now, the other thing that's cropped up, and someone got in touch with us, and highlighted Sainsbury's Bank for this. Sainsbury's Bank have raised rates on its easy access and on its cash ISAs, but you have to phone up to get the better rate, even though it's a variable rate, which I think is absolutely scandalous. I think it's absolutely crazy that people are having to phone up to get the better rate on a variable rate deal. You sign up for a variable rate and you expect to have the rise automatically applied to your account. It'll be buried somewhere deep in the terms and conditions. The real big issue is that we've had at least three people write in saying that it's taken 45 minutes on the phone and basically getting nowhere, you know, to get this rate boost. So if that's someone, if you've been affected by that or from any other bank that's done that, please let us know, because
I hope that phone line's free. I really want to
highlight all this rubbish, Georgie. You know, it's just awful. Absolutely, it's incredible. So that you can now get 1.6% on an easy access rate. Rate's gone up again today. There's a new rate. So you can get 1.6% with Al Rayan Bank, or you can get 1.5% with Atom Bank. Pretty easy just to go and do that. It does not take long at all. Well worth doing. And then in the same breath, we've got fixed rates. Fixed rates are really going higher. I mean, they're just being supercharged. And it's kind of like, at the moment, it's, do you want to fix now or do you want to wait if base rate keeps going higher? And, the mood music really is that we're going to see base rate probably head higher. Is the next rate rise going to be 0.25 percentage points, or is it going to be 0.5? I think that's playing a lot in people's minds. But you can now, for 2 years, get 3.08%, which is a pretty good rate. And again, none of the high street banks are getting anywhere close to offering anything like that. So if you are in the market for a fix, well worth doing. If you are someone that wants to boost the rate, but they're waiting for base rate rises because you think there's going to be better rates on the horizon, which, this plays a little bit into the 10 tips thing we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. Saying fix if you think the rate looks good. That these rates look good, what possibly you could do is A, open up one of these Best Buy easy access rates, put it in there for now, wait it out for a couple of months, and probably fixed rates are going to continue head higher, then do it. Or I quite like a notice account. Accounts are pretty good. They're sort of halfway house between an easy access and a fixed rate. The rates on some of those are pretty good at the moment. I don't know them off the top of my head, but they're like in between an easy access and fixed rates. So you could park your cash in there. Usually the minimum term is 35 days. So you'd have to give 35 days notice to take that cash out and then open a new account with it. But it could be an option if you are someone that's sitting around. One thing I will say, though, is, I really, really would like to see more people just pull money out of these absolute dud easy access rates and just head elsewhere. It's criminal, some of these rates. 0.01%, a base rate of 1.25%, and an SVR at 5.74%. It blows my mind. And actually, the one thing I should add here is completely up to the banks and Barclays and whoever to set their rates. They can set whatever rate they want, their business, but customers don't have to accept that rate. They can go somewhere else. We've also had readers get in touch, Georgie, about Barclays just withdrawing overdrafts from people in the cost of living crisis. They're just pulling the overdraft limit, and they're saying it's part of an annual review of people's accounts. So if you haven't dipped into your overdraft in the last 12 months, they might automatically just take your overdraft away because they deem it as unnecessary and that you don't need it. Which in this current climate, there's probably going to be quite a few people that may not have dipped into their overdrafts in the last 12 months, but possibly will do in the next 12 months.
But I don't understand. So if you're not using it, what difference does it make to Barclays either way than keep it or not keep it? I'm lost.
They did this to people with their credit cards, didn't they? Barclays cards. Remember that one?
I do.
Lots of loyal, long-standing customers, many of whom had their credit card limits raised repeatedly by Barclays card in years gone by, with text messages saying, "We're raising your credit limit. If you don't want us to raise your credit limit, get in touch." So they just defaulted to doing it. And then all of a sudden, absolutely sliced people's credit limits down to largely unusable levels. And they said, they sent out letters saying it's because your financial circumstances have changed due to coronavirus. But when actually quizzed on this, they did admit that they hadn't looked into people's financial circumstances in most cases. I know this because it happened to me and I was one of them, and they hadn't looked at my financial circumstances at all. And they made my credit limit, reduced it to the point where it was so low I couldn't do it. And they did it to people who hadn't been spending on their credit cards. We don't know exactly why they did this, but there is a suggestion that basically what they needed to do was reduce the amount of potential credit they were on the hook for. And it's to do with banking capitalization stuff and everything like that. And so that they've just gone through just like chop, 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 chop. The irony being that if you did live on your credit card and use your credit card all the time, and I think the same thing's hitting here, if you did live in your overdraft and use it all the time, you'd end up with it. So they've done it to quite a lot of their loyal and potentially more creditworthy customers, I believe.
It's an odd one, isn't it? I'm on Barclays' website at the minute, and it says click here to find out. what the interest rate rise means for if you've got mortgages or savings. So I clicked onto the savings, 0.01, 0.1, 0.01, 0.15, 0.3, 0.01. Good if you're a child, 1.51. So really, it doesn't actually mean anything.
I think we should say Barclays did come back to us, okay, on this, and they did give a
proper
reason
journalism
for this.
Here. Okay, yes, yeah, right reply. Yeah.
We gave them the right reply. Lee, I'll leave this to you to explain because it was you they spoke to.
Yeah, I have to be careful because a lot of it was on background. You know that classic, this is on background. So, you know, I have to be a little bit careful what I say. But yeah, to be honest, none of it's really well. I didn't even include it in the story because it was just usual bank gibberish of, you know, we're constantly reviewing rates, blah, 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 blah. I will say, though, that one banking giant who will remain nameless kind of hinted that savers aren't really bothered about the rate. They're more bothered about keeping the money under one roof. That was a hint that I got from one banking giant, because this story was focusing in all banks, just so we know. And adding, I'm just going to again add another tip, actually, Georgia, if I may, for our, you know, theme of this podcast is don't trust the banks. Loyalty never pays.
Yeah,
and that's what I would say. That's one for the.
And read the small print, because you did mention that earlier. Exactly. Yes. Just a quick one on Barclays. Mortgage customers, what should they do with the SVR shooting up?
Don't pay the SVR.
There you go.
It's like, there you go. If you're on your bank's SVR, why? Why are you on it?
Are you there for 250. Fun? Okay.
Yeah. And you might have a good reason. You might be paying the standard variable rate, which is a bank's high variable rate that they move people onto after fixed rate deals, because maybe you're going to move soon. Or you need to remortgage in 3 months' time, but not now. But if you're just sitting on it, paying that rate, you could almost certainly fix your mortgage and save yourself a substantial amount of money. You are needlessly paying the bank more money than you need to. And if it really is that you don't like to be tied down, okay, you just need to be able to leave whenever you want to, go get yourself a lifetime tracker rate, right, with no early repayment charge, which again is almost certainly going to be cheaper than that SVR and is guaranteed to only move in line with the Bank of England base rate if you get the right kind of lifetime tracker, rather than can potentially be moved in any which way that your bank fancies it. Most people on SVRs should not be paying SVRs. And maybe you just think, oh, well, you know what, my mortgage isn't that big. It's just not really that much point. You are needlessly giving a bank or building society more money than you need to. Okay, they don't need your money. They pay their chief executives millions of pounds a year. I bet you're not paid millions of pounds a year. So stop giving them that money.
Indeed. Before we move on, do you both have savings accounts? Do you know what rates you're on is what I'm going to ask you.
I've got many, many savings accounts. Some of them, do I know them all? Some of them I know what rate I'm on. Yeah. Some of them I know quite how little money the bank is paying me.
Yeah.
And I am doing this because I'm an idiot. And I have left the money in those accounts because conveniently they're attached to the bank where I have my current account. And therefore, the bank gets away with paying me an insult rate because it's convenient for me.
Yeah.
Now, just to be clear to any one of these banks that may have suggested that people like this, I don't like it. It's because I'm lazy.
Right. Know thyself, Simon.
And bank, bank that is doing this to me, you are mugging me off, and I'm allowing myself to be mugged off, and that makes me a mug. But so I should, what I should do is use that time that I've diarized in this podcast to do something about it.
Yeah. Take responsibility, Simon. Really, really think about it. In the next 30 minutes that you've Google invited yourself, you know, I want you to sit down in a quiet room and think about your actions. Lee Boyce?
I have, I've got two savings accounts, Georgie. I know exactly the rate. I've got one regular saver at the moment. It's 3.5% because I quite like doing the regular saver. Now, I say 3.5%, but it doesn't work quite that way because there's a maximum limit of £300 a month that can go into it. But I quite like doing it and then trying to max it out and then get into a year's time. And then, you know, it's quite a nice way to just payday, get it straight out of your account and do it. I've got premium bonds, you know, nice little sum in there. And the rest of the spare cash is in stocks and shares, ISA.
Fair enough. Very good.
What about you? Have you got some dud savings accounts dotted around?
I did have to just double check there. I'd be lying if I said I knew. Similar to yourself, got it dotted around. The easy access, I could do better. I'm on 0.74. I could do better.
You're doing better than average, though.
I'm doing better than Barclays customers, though. But I could do better. I like your idea of sort of playing the system, Lee. I feel like I just need to gamify this a bit more. But anyway, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Ben Layler of eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Welcome, Ben.
Great to be here. We've had a lot of political drama here in the UK and also in Italy, with Mario Draghi resigning as prime minister. But markets have really been driven by two other things, US inflation and company earnings. US inflation hit a new high over 9%, and investors are now bracing for the US Federal Reserve to lead the world in raising interest rates even faster. On top of that, we also had a wobbly start to global second quarter earnings, with US banks like JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley seeing lower profits as they prepare for a potential recession.
So that's the bad news from this week. What do we have to look forward to next week? Anything a bit brighter?
I think you've probably got the wrong guest for that. Next week, we are braced for another rise in UK inflation. And we have the European Central Bank starting to raise interest rates for the first time in over a decade. Plus, the earnings reports are just going to keep coming. We're going to see the likes of heavyweights like Tesla and Netflix in the US, and closer to the home, Anglo American and Ocado.
Welcome back. Now, we've had so many false predictions before, but could this really be the moment that the housing bubble bursts? Economists are warning prices could fall by up to 10% soon, as rising interest rates cause property markets across the globe to crash. Now, rising borrowing costs and the anticipation of further hikes in coming months are already fueling sharp downturns in housing markets across advanced economies, including the UK. Now, that is according to Neil Shearing, chief economist at Capital Economics. Now, before we dig into this, Simon, I just want to ask Capital Economics, who they? Now, the reason I say that is because it seems that every time there's a prediction of some sort, they are the most grim, like interest rate rises, stock market falls, house prices. Who they?
An independent economic analysis forecasting consultancy founded by Roger Bootle, very well respected. Yes, I suppose you could say they are more bearish. They are on the more bearish end quite consistently with their forecasts. But, you know, these are forecasts that are...
Well, it makes the press, not to be cynical.
Yeah. No, but, you know, they are taken seriously. It's not just like totally wild stuff made up by some people looking for some... coverage.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
It's quite more in depth than that. I think there is a scenario where interest rates go up by more than people think, or the effect of interest rates going up, even by as much as people think they're going to go up, is still being undercalculated. Maybe people are being a bit too over-optimistic, a bit of Dr. Pangloss going on here. And that actually this could have a much greater effect on the consumer economy and the housing market and ultimately the stock market as well. I mean, there's a question here with the stock market is a lot of shares are being priced for recession at the moment, and being priced for quite a hefty recession. Some consumer facing companies, are they going to be as badly hit as people think? The optimistic case is it's already priced in. And actually, some of them are going to do better. And if you take, for example, Marks and Spencer, okay, maybe say a year ago, people were quite optimistic on Marks. They thought that it was finally turning a corner and that actually things were on the up. Since January this year, when its share price hit a recent high, been absolutely pummeled. I mean, the shares have nearly halved in value, you know, since the start of the year. Is it going to be hit as badly as people think? And if you thought that actually the turnaround story was underway, you know, the structural stuff going on there, has it got dramatically worse in terms of the actual business itself? Or is it just people are thinking that its customers are going to get hit that badly? Are Marx's customers going to be hit as badly as people think that those shares are only worth half as much? I would say maybe not. But the flip side of that is, this could be much worse than people think. People are suddenly going to really get hit by these interest rate rises. Central banks have made it perfectly clear that they're happy to raise rates into a recession. They're not worried about the housing market and supporting it. They're not worried about the stock market and supporting it. That they are really worried about inflation, and actually it's going to be worse than people think. Thus feeding into this whole suggestion that house prices could come off the boil. There's lots of people suggesting that what's going to happen is house prices are just going to stop going up and then they're going to plateau. Or they're maybe going to dip by like a percent or two. Now, the other suggestion is that buying the same house now as 2 years ago has got dramatically more expensive due to the rise in interest rates and the fact that that house is also dramatically more expensive than it was 2 years ago. And when things come off the boil, that you tend to get, you know, a fall. Things to swing too far one way and then they swing too far the other way. They don't tend to just swing too far and then just kind of stop and then not come down. Who knows?
Also within this, thank you for explaining that, Simon. Also within this, capital economics expert said that the recent surge in prices, house prices, looks alarmingly similar to what happened in the run-up to the global financial crisis, although he noted that a crisis of the scale of 2008 was unlikely. Ooh, what's the picture like, Lee?
I think another rule to add to the list is take forward forecasts with a pinch of salt. because, you know, it's very difficult to really predict what's going to go on. And if you keep chucking out forecasts, someone's going to be right at some point and you can claim that you saw it coming. Mm. I think that's what a lot of these kind of forecasters attempt to do. A little bit controversial. But as I said to Simon in the office this week, when we saw this, I said house prices in the last year, according to Halifax, are up 13%. So essentially, even if they drop 10%, you know, most people wouldn't really, it wouldn't make a detrimental impact, I would suggest, as much as it would have done in a financial crisis. But in terms of the picture, I mean, we're talking globally here, Georgie. I think that there's a lot of pressures facing the same Western economies, to be quite frank. And as Simon said there, that's what they're sort of alluding to in this story, that as we keep saying, mortgage rates are at record lows and people snapping up properties. Since the start of the pandemic, we could never have forecast how quickly house prices were going to grow in this country and as fast as they've done. So those kind of ingredients all put together kind of makes you say, well, there's got to be some sort of house price correction at some point because logic dictates. But we keep seeing house price indexes, which look at the actual statistics of the last 12 months, painting a different picture at the moment. That house price is still going up because of supply and demand issue. There's still people that want to buy homes. At one point, a couple of months ago, it looked like things were cooling a bit, but now we've had indexes that suggest that actually there's been heat back in the market. So it's really hard to know what's next. And that's why I'm always a little bit sort of cynical about this kind of stuff, because I think we, having been in financial journalism for a long time, we see all of these kind of forecasts all the time. And I've just realized it's impossible. You can't confidently tell me how much house prices would have grown or fallen this time next year. If we did this podcast on the 15th of July, 2023, all sorts of things could have happened in between. Got absolutely no idea. But I thought it was quite interesting, actually, in this research. It says forecast drops of between 5 and 10% in the UK, but actually predicting bigger falls in some other countries. So New Zealand and Canada, for example, they're suggesting 20% falls. Australia, 15% falls. And in the US, they're saying 5% falls. So what I think that is, and what I'm trying to say with this forecast and what they're predicting, is it is a real global property. I wouldn't call it a crash, because it doesn't feel like a crash if there's been a 13% price increase in the last year and then it goes down 5 to 10%. That's not a crash. That's just a kind of bit of leveling around, you know. So I don't know, interesting piece of research, interesting forecast. Put it in your Google diary or whatever, Simon, for this time next year, and we'll see how accurate it was.
I would say one thing though, right? We don't know what's going to happen to house prices, and I would take any forecast for anything with a pinch of salt. But you can work out how much more it would cost you to buy your house by using a mortgage calculator. So I've just used our mortgage finder, right? If you want to go play this game, thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, right? Or just go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages and you'll find a link to it. I moved home 2 years ago. And if I was to move home now, borrowing the exact same amount to buy the same house, the mortgage would be about £400 a month more, which is quite a big difference. But of course, I couldn't buy that same house now with the same mortgage for the same price, because the price of said house has gone up, right? And allowing, if you allow for that, the house price inflation, and being relatively conservative on it, it would cost me £1,500 a month more on the mortgage to buy this same house now. I don't have a spare £1,500 a month, right? I wouldn't be able to afford that. Obviously, there is the answer of like, well, you can't buy that same house. You have to downgrade your expectations and so on. So it doesn't quite work in the way that I'm saying this, but it does illustrate quite how big a difference this whole like mortgage rates rising at the same time as you've had the house prices rising by quite a bit, what the effect of that is. That definitely is going to have a chilling effect on the market.
Lee, there's another piece by Helen, because I think a lot of people that are worrying at the moment, well, lots of people are worrying at the moment, but first time buyers, particularly when you're looking at house price rises, they're praying for this capital economics research to be true. But our Helen Crane, regular of the podcast, has been writing to reassure first-time buyers who may be feeling somewhat panicked or pressured to buy right now because of all the talks of rising mortgage rates because of the base rate going up. And what is she saying? What precipitated this piece as well?
Well, first of all, I should point out here saying that Money Facts data over the last month suggested one of the biggest monthly mortgage rate increases sort of on record. And the typical five-year fix now is at the most expensive it's been since 2014. So in that kind of backdrop, you know, and that is playing in people's minds, that they're worried that their mortgage payments are just going to be going higher and higher and higher until they get on the property ladder, because rates look likely to be going up. Now, what Helen's saying in this column piece, which was, I thought, really good piece, actually, is, you know, don't panic as a first-time buyer. The first and foremost thing is, are you buying the right property for you at this moment in time? You know, is this what you want to buy? Don't feel pressured into buying something that's not right for you. Now, what prompted this was a press release that got sent through from Metro Bank. And basically, in capital letters, it was advising first-time buyers to buy now. That is actually what it put in the press release, buy now in capital letters. And it was like a red rag to a bull to Helen, because she's looking at that going, that is quite irresponsible advice, to be quite frank. And as she points out in this story, most first-time buyers are going to have a 5 or a 10% mortgage, deposit mortgage, so an LTV at 90 or 95%. And actually, they are the mortgage types that have seen the lowest rises in terms of rate rises at the moment. You know, whether that continues, it's hard to say. But I think it's quite, you should never be panicked into buying a home. It shouldn't be a panicking situation. It shouldn't be, you've got this deposit now, you've got to buy something right now, what you can afford right now. And then you end up buying something that is completely wrong, because, you know, don't forget, you've got to live in it. And you might be living in it for quite a bit of time, depending on how life pans out and all of that kind of thing. So what Helen's sort of, it's just calling for a bit of calm, you know, not to panic, to still make the same decisions and take your time as you would, you know, when you buy a property. When you look at a property, you want to go and really kick the tires, have a look around, make sure what you're buying is correct and for you, making sure that you still do all of the relevant checks, you know, potentially getting a survey and all of that kind of thing, because you could end up being, you know, a ruinous financial decision. So Take your time. It is the biggest thing you're ever going to buy, probably, unless you're Rishi Sunak. You know, it is going to be like, you've just got to take your time. Due diligence should be on the list, actually, thinking about it.
Always this list due is diligence. Getting very long.
It's getting, it could be written on one of those sort of like long headstones. Was it Ed Miliband?
The headstone.
We could get the headstone. Maybe we could make that the Lambert stone.
Halcyon days, weren't they? Halcyon days. And finally, your flight being cancelled and your holiday ruined is awful. Sorry, it's just awful. But alas, it doesn't end there. The battle for compensation is a long and arduous one. But please, don't give up. Lee, you have a guide to make sure that you get every single penny you are owed. And so hopefully it's less stressful because you've written a guide, and if you read it, then it's just going to be less stressful, right?
Yeah, I think cool. I think you're totally right, Georgie. And actually, I'm going to add just one last thing to this list. Just keeping with the theme. I'm sorry.
We've got time. Lee, you can have more than that if you want. We've got at least another 5 minutes.
I have been teaching my 3-year-old, soon to be 4-year-old daughter, some sayings in life. So she'll constantly come up with some of these sort of real cliche sayings. The first one I ever taught her was "Don't sweat the small stuff." Now, actually, I taught her that while we were on holiday. So don't sweat the small stuff. I think when it comes to your holiday, you shouldn't sweat the small stuff. Now, this is big stuff because airlines, airports, everything's in chaos. But you deserve a holiday, right? And we're coming up to the summer holidays now, half term for children, all that kind of thing. Don't be put off from having a holiday because of what's going on at airports and airlines. You know, you deserve it. You deserve to book that trip and you deserve to go for it. I think it's an absolute outrage how some of these airports have been so woefully unprepared for the pent-up demand that was quite clearly going to be there, and basically put us in a situation in, I would say now, that Heathrow is almost a global embarrassment for what has happened. It is absolutely disgraceful. People work hard, they save hard, and they want to go and have a relaxing holiday. And what are we in now? A kind of zone, a funk in which if you've booked a holiday, all you're thinking about in the run-up to the holiday is, am I going to get to take this holiday? If you get on the plane, if you're lucky enough to get there, get your baggage, all of that kind of thing, then the panic of throughout the rest of the holiday, am I going to get flown home as promised at this time? I would just say, take a deep breath, try and relax. This is what a holiday is about. It's about, you should be zen. You should be relaxed about it. It should be like a feeling of excitement and joy, not this absolute crazy scenario which we're in, where Heathrow is having to cap flights and all sorts of nonsense is going on. Now, if unfortunately your flight does get cancelled, or you know, your trip is cancelled, you should have 14 days notice. Now, that is typically what you would get, and you would get your flight refunded. You would probably get your hotel refunded, depending on how you've booked. If it's through a travel agent, it should all be covered, and it should all be fine. If you book the hotel separately, it might be a different scenario, but the airline still has a responsibility, especially. Actually, this is more appropriate for what's going on at the moment, is these last minute cancellations, these cancellations in which people were being told on the day or turning up at the airport and finding that their flight has been cancelled and their trip is basically ruined, which I can't believe we're in a scenario in which that's happening.
I'm still freaked out by Simon's story from last week about, I can't remember who it was, Simon, they were in Nice and they found out from the taxi driver that the flight was cancelled and there was no one at the BA checking to even talk to. I thought the Civil Aviation Authority had written to the airlines and told them that they've got some sort of responsibility. Do you need to be written to have a responsibility to do business?
It was my sister. I'm not sure if she's got her money back yet. The thing that they're playing particularly fast and loose on is the fact that you're entitled to travel on the original day of departure if there is any commercial way of getting you to your destination. That means that your airline should put you onto another flight with another airline if it can't get you there. And the airline should go and sort that out for you. Now, this is not what is happening. They're giving people flights in a couple of days' time, and then they're not helping people find other flights. And so when you should then, if they give you a flight in a couple of days' time, you should be allowed to go find your own flight, and then you can claim the cost of that flight back off them. So they refund you the money for your original flight, and then they pay the difference if there is a difference, right? But they're not, you know, they're making people jump through a lot of hoops to do that. And you get the suspicion that they're turning down claims first time, second time, because they think people will just go away. They're also meant to compensate you if it was cancelled within 14 days. You know, that is the law. But it's just such chaos. It is such chaos that you wonder how they're ever going to process all of these claims.
Lee, give us some final top tips then to take away.
Well, as Simon says there, you've got to persevere, because it does feel like people are being batted away And I think the thing is, a lot of people are having to book things like transfers and accommodation and all that kind of thing. If your flight is cancelled within 14 days or you're stranded abroad, it goes without saying that you're going to need help finding somewhere to stay until you can get onto the next flight. And some people are having to make decisions of booking a flight, even though they should be put on this flight because it's the next commercially available flight and it's not happening. So I think what's happening a lot of the time when people are abroad is that there's no staff from the carrier there to actually help out and do this and help people get home, which again is just incredible. And if your flight is cancelled within, you know, outside of that 14-day period, so if it falls under that, you can claim compensation on top of your refund. So for a short haul journey under 932 miles, it's £220. 350 quid if it's between that and 2,174 miles, and £520 for longer flights, and that's per passenger. It's really difficult to tell people what to do and how to do it in terms of holidays at the moment. I'd said on this podcast a little while back that I went to New York and I braved Heathrow, and I got a text message. So, you know, it was a flight at 8:30 in the morning on a Friday morning. And I got a text message the night before. I stayed in a hotel near Heathrow just because it was just easier. And it was quite cheap, actually, to be fair. And I got a text message at 11:30. It was somewhere between 11:30 and midnight from BA saying, turn up at the airport at least 3 hours early. We're expecting delays in queues. Now, that is not putting me in the holiday vibe before I get a flight, and that's not going to encourage me to have a good night's sleep before I get on the flight. So lo and behold, I got to Heathrow. It was from Terminal 5. I got to the airport at 5:30. There was no one there. I got straight through at the BA gate, straight through at security, and I just thought, this is just needlessly panicking people. Like, fancy sending that. And actually, I heard someone. I was on the coach, the little transfer from the hotel to Terminal 5, and I heard someone say to another couple how ridiculous it was that they'd received a text message from BA just before midnight telling them to get to the airport, and all it did was meant they didn't have a good night's sleep. So
I'm one of those people that always turn up 3 hours at least early anyway.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, at the moment, it is definitely one of those things where you just want to get through and enjoy yourself. Yeah, but the other thing I was going to add to that is, I actually booked the hotel and flight separately. Now, I booked the hotel via booking.com. And what I did is I left it to not pay it straight away and to kick the can down the road and to pay for it like the week before we went to New York. But basically, the reason I did that is that I was worried at the time I booked it last summer, thinking about coronavirus, restrictions and all of that kind of stuff and whether we'd even get to go. So I thought I'd kick the can down the road and pay for it nearer the time. Well, I ended up doing myself out of a fair few hundred quid doing that because of dollar to pound. It wasn't locked in at that pound price. It was locked in at that dollar price. So when I had to pay for the hotel the week before the holiday, dollars strengthened so much against the pound that, you know, it ended up costing me a bit of money for that peace of mind. But it's really, really difficult. All I would say is if you've got a holiday booked or you're thinking about booking a holiday, just still go ahead with it and just do some research and know your rights and, you know, probably book with an airline which does have a big customer service kind of helpline and everything, and pray for the best, I guess, yeah. Georgie. Just pray for
God,
the best.
We've got
I think
to that level, have we? Pray.
I was talking to a colleague the other day and he said, Ryanair from Stansted. That's his answer. That's what he's doing for the time being. Flying Ryanair, flying from Stansted. Ryanair haven't cancelled anywhere near as many flights as EasyJet and BA.
And I also read, I can't remember exactly where this was, and I'd have to dig out a piece of research, but there was a piece last weekend showing the percentages of flights that have been cancelled at each airport. And Stansted was definitely at the bottom of that list. It was something like only 0.5% or something had been cancelled from Stansted.
Yeah, I mean, Heathrow, you know, we've all seen that news this week. That's like absolute chaos there. Gatwick's had a lot of problems, hasn't it? Luton Airport is just carnage all the time anyway. But Stansted appears to be amazingly. I don't know why. It's about minimising your risk, isn't it? I'm not saying there's no risk, but it's about minimising your risk.
Top tip. What I would just say as sort of a call out to the airlines, I mean, it's one thing for us to tell people to know your rights, but when you are there trying to assert your rights and you're coming up against a staff member, if you're lucky, who has no idea. And I say this in shops as well. Educate your staff on what consumer rights are, because by not doing it, and there is no excuse to treat staff badly, but you are exposing your staff to some very irate passengers who do know their rights. So for the love of God, please protect your staff in these situations, is all I would request to airlines, because this is a very stressful time. People will be very tired. Lee?
I was just going to add, Georgie, I found this piece of research. I just had a quick look. So more than 3% of flights from Gatwick have been cancelled so far this year, and that compares to 0.3% at Stansted, and Stansted is the best performing British hub. But actually, more flights have been cancelled in the US, Canada, Indonesia, Turkey. Again, so showing that it's a bit of a global problem. Where that stands at the end of the year with Heathrow and that cap might be slightly different. But it's definitely worth digging around and finding which airline, as Simon says, and airport are most likely to get you to your destination.
Or just stay at home and enjoy the lovely weather we're having. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? Helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.